intense torture. With never a word of complaint, even when he had to ride with his leg resting in a sling attached to his saddle. His soldiers loved and admired him, as indeed did almost all of those with whom he came into contact. They loved him for his personal charm, his kindness and, a rare quality perhaps in his day, his sense of humour. There was also his appreciation of the finer things in life, of painting, for example. A children still told the famous story of how he immediately stooped to pick up Titian's paintbrush when the master dropped it, or of music, for which he had a genuine passion. Even his gluttony evokes sympathy in many of us. He died a disappointed man, all too conscious of how much he had had to leave undone. But he understood, far more than most people realized, just how much that his beautiful and pleasurable life has to offer. And whenever he had the chance, he enjoyed it. The face of Western Europe was changing fast. Just 8 weeks after Charles's death, Queen Mary of England followed him to the grave, to be succeeded on the throne by her half-sister Elizabeth. The year 1559 saw in July the fatal wounding of King Henry II, see page 206. In August, the death of the odious Pope Paul IV, regretted by none, and on Christmas Day, the election of Giovanni Medici, to his shame, sorrow, and considerable embarrassment, no relation, as Pius IV. In 1560, Henry's heir, Francis II, husband of Mary, Queen of Scots, died in his turn a month before his 17th birthday, leaving the throne to his brother, Charles IX. Apart from the death of the Pope, there had been one other item of good news in 1559, the conclusion in April of the Peace of Cateau-Cambrésis. Spain had beaten France on points, thanks in large measure to the assistance given by the House of Savoy. This was one of the oldest ruling families of Europe, having been founded in the year 1003. Its members have at various times held the titles of King of Sicily, King of Sardinia, King of Croatia, King of Spain, King of Cyprus, King of Armenia, King of Jerusalem, and Emperor of Ethiopia. They were also to provide the four kings of Italy from the country's unification in March 1861 to June 1946, when it became a republic. By the middle of the 16th century, it covered the area of the present Italian region of Piedmont, together with the French departments of Savoie and Haute-Savoie, with its capital at Chambéry. The capital was to be moved to Turin in 1563. All had been well until Francis I had invaded and occupied it in 1536. Duke Charles III, the Good, and his son Emmanuel Philibert, who succeeded his father in 1553, were then effectively exiled, and had thus become enthusiastic allies of Charles V. Charles III and Charles V were brothers-in-law, having respectively married the two sisters Beatrix and Isabella of Portugal. The peace, which was signed by Henry II and Philip, both by proxy, restored to the House of Savoy all its former territories, and Henry renounced any further claims in Italy. This meant that Philip kept direct control of Milan, Naples, Sicily, and Sardinia. It also meant that the only truly independent states in Italy were Savoy and the Republic of Venice. France, on the other hand, regained the plundered towns of St. Quentin and kept Calais. The English were predictably furious about this latter provision, but there was nothing they could do. Meanwhile, the agreement was sealed with the gift, by Henry to Emmanuel Philibert, of the hand of his sister Margaret, Duchess of Berry, now aged 36 and described by a contemporary as a spinster lady of excellent breeding and lively intellect. The wedding celebrations were tragically clouded by King Henry's jousting accident and death a few days later. Just before he lost consciousness, obviously fearful lest Emmanuel Philibert should take advantage of his death to renege on the alliance, he ordered that his sister's wedding should take place immediately. Plans for an elaborate service at Notre Dame were scrapped. The two were married at a midnight ceremony in a small church near the place where the king lay dying. Queen Catherine de' Medici, the bride's sister-in-law, sat apart from the rest, making no effort to restrain her tears. With peace now concluded, at least temporarily, in Europe, Philip decided in the summer of 1559 that the time had come for him to tackle the Turks. His target would be Tripoli, the most formidable centre of Corsair activity along the whole Barbary coast. He consulted with the Viceroy of Sicily, the Duke of Medina Celi, whom he appointed commander-in-chief of the coming expedition, and also with Jean de Lavalette, Grand Master of the Knights of St. John, obviously hoping to regain the city which his order had lost to the Turks only 8 years before. Over the next 6 months, Philip gathered a fleet of about 100 ships, including 53 galleys, together with troops from Italy, Spain, and Germany. The idea was a surprise attack, but, as he should have known from his father's disaster at Algiers in 1541, large-scale offensives during the winter in the Mediterranean were never a good idea. 5 times the fleet put out to sea from its base in Malta, 5 times it was blown back to port. 6 precious weeks were lost. 2,000 men succumbed to illness of one kind or another. Spring came, bringing with it more reasonable weather, and the fleet, supplemented now with papal and perhaps surprisingly French contingents, set sail not directly for Tripoli, but for the island of Djerba off the Tunisian coast, which Medinaceli had chosen as a base for his operations. This was occupied without difficulty. But then, on the 11th of May, a Turkish fleet of 86 vessels under the young admiral Pial Pasha appeared on the horizon. Pial had been alerted by one of the leading corsairs, Kilic Ali, and had broken all records by completing the journey from Istanbul in just 20 days. The Christians, taken completely by surprise and overwhelmingly outnumbered, had little option but flight. Wholesale panic followed as the Turks moved in for the kill. 20 galleys and 27 transport vessels were sunk, 18,000 soldiers killed or drowned. Pial returned in triumph to Istanbul with 5,000 prisoners, his ships towing the captured enemy hulks, now rudderless and shorn of their masts. There then took place a magnificent victory parade through the city, the streets lined by cheering crowds, the captured admirals and commanders bringing up the rear. The Sultan appeared on a magnificently decorated platform to take the salute. According to the ambassador Buzbek, his expression was so severe and sad that one would have thought that the victory did not concern him, and that nothing new or unexpected had occurred. He was, however, appreciative enough to grant to Pial, as a reward, the hand of one of his granddaughters in marriage. Suleiman was now in his 66th year, and had been 40 years on the throne. He was still in fine physical condition, but inevitably he had aged, and he was now worrying increasingly about the succession. Mustafa had been safely dispatched, but now the Sultan's 2 surviving sons, Bayezid and Selim, were at each other's throats, and, Roxolana having died in 1558, no longer had a mother to control them. Soon their quarrel turned into open warfare, and on the 31st of May 1559, Selim met his brother in a battle outside Konya, and soundly defeated him. Bayezid escaped to Persia with his 5 sons and a small army, fully prepared to continue the fight. Shah Tamast I gave him a friendly welcome, but all too soon Suleiman, convinced by Selim that his brother was a traitor busy plotting his overthrow, sent envoys to the Shah requesting him to make arrangements for the young prince's execution. Finally, it was a Turkish executioner who did the job on the 25th of September 1561. Selim was now the sole remaining heir to the Ottoman Empire. How, one wonders, could the Sultan, normally so far-sighted and so shrewd, have twice allowed himself to be persuaded, the first time by his wife, the second time by one of his children, to destroy the 2 ablest of his sons, and indeed the only 2 who might have shown themselves to be worthy successors to himself? Perhaps all absolute monarchs are to some degree paranoid, given to imagining plots and conspiracies where none exists. Perhaps, too, and this seems particularly true of dictators who have no obvious heirs, they become so intoxicated with their own power that they simply do not or dare not contemplate their country's future when their hands shall no longer be at the helm. Few, certainly, have ever made the slightest effort to ensure an effective succession. The idea of après moi le déluge may, in short, be a good deal more commonly held among aging autocrats than we realize. Suleiman still had 5 more years to live. He had devoted his entire life to almost constant campaigning, and for one reason only, to increase the extent and power of his empire. How could he so deliberately, so consciously, have arranged matters in such a way as to ensure that after his death that empire would pass to a drunken debauchee of all the 36 Ottoman sultans, by far the worst? For the 5 years after 1560, the eastern and central Mediterranean was comparatively quiet. There was, inevitably, spasmodic naval harassment of one fleet by another, but there were no large-scale engagements. From the Turkish point of view, by far the most persistent troublemakers were the Knights of St. John. They had now adopted a policy of out-and-out piracy, waylaying all the Muslim pilgrim ships that they could find bound for ports near Mecca and exacting heavy charges before allowing them to proceed on their way. There was still greater anger at the port when it was reported that the Knights had seized a ship bringing goods destined for the imperial harem and forced it to unload its cargo in Malta. Whether some of these goods were intended particularly for Suleiman's daughter Miriam is uncertain, but she seems to have worked on her father to persuade him that outrages such as this could no longer be tolerated. In 1564, the Sultan celebrated his 70th birthday. He had had plenty of time to regret his merciful treatment of the Knights after his seizure of Rhodes in 1522. He had granted them his safe conduct from the island only in return for a promise never again to take up arms against him. Never had a promise been so flagrantly or so repeatedly broken. Now that the Knights had been settled for some 35 years in their new home, they were becoming as persistent a nuisance as ever they had been. Clearly the time had come to expel them from Malta, just as he had expelled them from Rhodes. And there was another reason too. Malta occupied a key position in the central Mediterranean, forming a natural stepping stone between Turkish-held Tripoli and Sicily, which was ruled by Philip of Spain. Once it had fallen into the hands of the Sultan, it would provide the perfect springboard for the conquest of that most desirable island, after which Turkish landings in South Italy would have followed as surely as night follows day. Charles V had been fully aware of this when, in 1530, he had made Malta available to the order. What better means could he hope for, at no cost to himself, of protecting the southern approaches to his empire? The Knights, it is true, had not been initially enthusiastic. They had considered the possibility of a move to Malta 6 years earlier, and had sent out 8 commissioners to find out what it had to offer. The island, the commissioners had reported, is merely a rock of soft sandstone called tufa, about 6 or 7 leagues long and 3 or 4 broad. It is actually hard sandstone and roughly 18 miles by 9. The surface of the rock is barely covered by no more than 3 or 4 feet of earth. This also is stony and most unsuited for growing corn or other cereals. It does, however, produce quantities of figs, melons, and other fruits. The principal trade of the island consists of honey, cotton, and cumin seed. These the inhabitants exchange for grain. Except for a few springs in the center of the island, there is no running water, not even wells, so the inhabitants catch the rainwater in cisterns. Wood is so scarce as to be sold by the pound, and the inhabitants have to use either sun-dried cow dung or thistles for cooking their food. Malta was not clearly an island designed to withstand a siege. On the other hand, it boasted 3 immense advantages. A limitless supply of mellow, honey-coloured building stone, a fine tradition of quarrymen, builders, stonemasons and carvers, and perhaps the most astonishing natural anchorage in the world. To this day, the first sight of Grand Harbour, seen either from a vessel entering it or from the heights of Valletta, cannot fail to catch the breath. It was unquestionably that anchorage that finally decided the Knights, after 8 years' homelessness, to accept the Emperor's offer of a permanent lease. The Knights never forgot that they were first and foremost hospitallers. For well over 5 centuries the care of the sick had been their raison d'être. No sooner had they settled in Birgu, now known as Vittoriosa, the northern of the 2 long headlands on the far side of Grand Harbour opposite Valletta, than they set about building a hospital. This first hospital still stands in Trix Santa Scholastica. It is now a convent of Benedictine nuns. Its predecessor in Rhodes had been famous throughout Christendom and visited by the sick of every nation in the Western world, and they were determined that a similar institution in Malta should be equally celebrated, as indeed it soon became. Their second priority was defence, the fortification of their superb harbour and their navy. Shipbuilding was no easy task on a treeless island. Thanks, however, to massive imports of timber from Sicily, over the next 30 years they gradually built up a considerable fleet, until by 1560 their sea power was probably as great as it had been in the old days on Rhodes. It was just as well. When they received the first reports of Suleiman's coming expedition, their navy at least was ready. Certainly they had no illusions about the danger they faced. Without vast reinforcements, they knew that they would be hopelessly outnumbered, both in men and in ships, and that they could expect little sustenance from their scanty, stony soil. They also knew, however, that the soil would show itself still more inhospitable to a besieging army. Geography, too, was on their side. Whereas Rhodes was only 10 miles from the Turkish coast, Malta was nearly 1,000. The invaders might possibly bring in some provisions from North Africa. Nonetheless, it was clear that the force that the Sultan was to hurl against them had from first to last to be largely self-supporting. Small wonder that his invasion fleet, carrying as it did not only his entire army of some 40,000 men with their horses, cannon, ammunition, siege, machinery, and military supplies, but also food and water and even fuel for cooking, was said to be one of the largest ever to embark on the high seas. It consisted of well over 200 ships, including 130 oared galleys, 30 galleasses. A galleass might be described as a cross between a galley and a galleon. It was designed to carry cargo and was largely dependent on sail, but was also fitted with oars and a fair weight of guns, and 11 tub-shaped merchantmen, which relied, like the galleons, entirely on sail. The remainder was made up of assorted smaller vessels, mostly barks and frigates. Swelling the numbers still further, though emphatically not part of the official expedition, were the privateers, circling like vultures around them. In 1557, at the age of 63, he was almost exactly the same age as Suleiman, Jean Parisson de La Valette had been elected 48th Grand Master of the Order of St. John. A Gascon, he is said to have been outstandingly handsome in his youth and to have spoken several languages fluently, including Italian, Spanish, Greek, Turkish, and Arabic. He was also a hard, implacable defender of the Christian faith. As a young knight of 28, he had fought at the Siege of Rhodes. Later, he had been captured and had endured a year as a Turkish galley slave. He was utterly single-minded in the service of the order, a man, it was said, equally capable of converting a Protestant or governing a kingdom. Faith, strength, leadership, and steel discipline, all were his. He was to need them all in the months that lay ahead. The knights, it need hardly be said, had their agents in Istanbul. They knew as soon as anyone when the Sultan began his preparations, and from the moment of his election, La Valette had had every able-bodied man in Malta working flat out to be ready for the battle to come. He had appealed for reinforcements of men and materials from the commandaries of the order that were scattered throughout Christian Europe. Even so, at the start of the siege, he could count on only some 540 knights, with their servants-at-arms, together with about 1,000 Spanish infantrymen and arquebusiers, and perhaps 4,000 local Maltese militia. He had also ordered emergency supplies of grain from Sicily and additional armaments and munitions from France and Spain. All his water systems were full, and he had no compunction in arranging for the waters of the Marsa, a low-lying region beyond Grand Harbour, which he knew must be the principal source of water for any besieging army, to be contaminated with dead animals when the time came. The great fleet appeared off the horizon on the 18th of May, 1565. The Sultan, feeling his age, had regretfully decided not to command it in person, as he had the attack on Rhodes over 40 years earlier. Instead, he had divided the command in two, the naval force to be the responsibility of Pial, the land army that of his brother-in-law, the veteran general Mustafa Pasha. It was to prove a catastrophic decision. The two men hated each other, Pial openly contemptuous of Mustafa's military skills, and Mustafa deeply jealous of the younger man's success and his popularity with the Sultan. Grand Harbour was obviously far too stoutly defended to be a possible site for disembarkation, and Pial eventually selected the harbour of Marsa Sirocco, now Marsak's Lock, at the southernmost tip of the island, some 5 miles away across country from Birgu. The knights made no attempt to stop him. They knew that they could have had little impact on so huge a force in the open sea, or even at a beachhead. Their one hope lay in their fortifications, from which they had no intention of emerging more than was absolutely necessary. The Turks, once ashore, then advanced towards the city, and pitched their camp on the land sloping down to the Marsa, from which they had a commanding view of the whole anchorage. There, stretching out before them, was the long central sweep of water leading to the open sea, with the three narrow creeks leading off to the right and to the left the long crest of Mount Skibberus, where Valletta stands today. At its furthest point, guarding the entrance to the harbour, rose the towering walls of one of the knight's two most impressive redoubts, the superbly garrisoned Fort St. Elmo. Had Pial elected, as he should have done, to keep his fleet in the south, where it would have been perfectly safe during the summer months, Fort St. Elmo would not have loomed large in Turkish calculations. Instead, he decided to bring his ships up the northeast coast and into the harbour of Marsamusetto, Marsamuxet, which runs along the northern side of Mount Skibberus. This provided a good deal more shelter. Unfortunately, it brought him once again into violent disagreement with Mustafa. It also involved sailing directly beneath the guns of the great fortress, the destruction of which thenceforth became a top priority. A cursory examination of Fort St. Elmo suggested to the Turks that, as a star-shaped fort of a fairly traditional kind, it might not be a particularly tough nut to crack. The principal difficulty would be the dragging of heavy guns for nearly 2 miles along the ridge of Mount Skibberus, where they would be within range of the guns from the headlands of Birgu and Senglia, on the opposite side of the harbour. Trench digging here was impossible. Within a few inches, the sappers' spades hit the solid rock. Thus, if the troops manhandling the huge cannon up the slopes and along the crest were to be protected, it could only be by constructing immense earthworks, which would in turn mean bringing up vast quantities of soil from the Marsa. All this consumed the energies of most of the Sultan's army, providing a welcome breathing space for La Valletta and his men as they worked around the clock to strengthen still further the defences of their other great redoubt, Fort St. Angelo, at the far end of Birgu. On the 23rd of May, the attack on St. Elmo began in earnest. Night and day the bombardment continued. A few days later, there arrived the most celebrated Ottoman commander on land or sea. The Christians called him Dragut, but he was known to his countrymen as Turgut Reis. After an early career as corsair under Barbarossa, he had succeeded him, on Barbarossa's death in 1546, as supreme commander of the Ottoman navy. He had already directed an earlier raid on Malta in July 1547, when he had done considerable damage. Now, at the age of 80, he took personal command of the siege, setting up new batteries to the north and south of the fort, which henceforth was to suffer a still more remorseless bombardment from three sides at once. By the end of the month, its walls were showing signs of imminent collapse. Every night, under cover of darkness, small boats from St. Angelo would slip across the harbour mouth to bring the garrison fresh troops and provisions, returning with the wounded for the hospital in Birgu. It was thanks only to them that the fort held out as long as it did. One night, however, a returning boat brought something more, a deputation from the besieged to tell the Grand Master that they could resist no longer. La Valette looked at them coldly and replied that if they were no longer prepared to defend St. Elmo, he would replace them with others who would, and that these would be led by himself. Ashamed, they returned to their posts. The fort might be doomed, but there was to be no surrender. Somehow, Fort St. Elmo survived for a total of 31 days. When at last, on the 23rd of June, the Turks smashed their way in, only about 60 of the 150-odd defenders remained alive. Of these, all but 9 were instantly decapitated, their bodies nailed, in mockery of the crucifixion, to wooden crosses and floated across the harbour mouth to the waters below St. Angelo. When La Valette saw them, he unhesitatingly ordered the immediate execution of all Turkish prisoners. Their heads were then rammed into the breaches of the two cannon on the upper bastion and fired back into the ruins of St. Elmo. There was no mistaking that message. Henceforth, no quarter would be asked or given. The Turks had achieved their first objective. They had done so, however, at the cost of nearly a month of the precious summer and of some 8,000 of their finest troops, almost a quarter of their entire army. Among them had been old Dragut, struck down by cannonball in the last stages of the siege of St. Elmo. Mustafa Pasha is said to have stood among the ruins, gazing through the haze of summer heat across the harbour. "If so small a son has cost us so dear," he murmured, "what price must we pay for the father?" The father was, of course, Fort St. Angelo itself. Behind it was the headland of Birgu, the knight's fortified city. Beyond the narrow inlet to the southwest lay the neighbouring headland of Senglia. It was on the defence of these two parallel peninsulas, by now completely surrounded by the Ottoman army, that the Order of St. John depended for its survival. They were connected by a flimsy bridge across the creek, now known as Dockyard Creek, and by a chain stretched on pontoons across its mouth. At the landward end, a palisade of stakes had been driven into the muddy bottom. No longer, however, after the fall of St. Elmo, could the entrance to Grand Harbour be blocked. The Turkish ships were now free to sail along its entire length, with only the guns of St. Angelo to hinder them. But there were consolations too. In order to move into their new positions south of Senglia and Birgu, the Turks would be obliged to drag all their heavy cannon, ammunition and supplies back along Mount Skibaris, and then around the harbour, over a good 4 miles of roads that were little more than cart tracks, in the fierce heat of a Maltese summer. Moreover, on the very day St. Elmo fell, ships from Sicily carrying a relief force of perhaps 1,000 all told, including 42 knights from northern Europe, had managed to land, and a week later, to make their way by night to what is now Kalkara, beyond another creek to the northeast of Birgu. Not only the arrival of the force itself, but also its almost miraculous success in avoiding the Turkish army, had an immense effect on the defenders' morale. But the struggle continued. In mid-July, a concerted attack on Senglia was made from the sea. It was foiled by the courage of the native Maltese, superb swimmers who tipped the Turks from their boats and fought them hand-to-hand in the water. A hidden gun emplacement completed the rout. On the 7th of August, an Italian gunner with the Spanish army, Francesco Balbi di Correggio, who was later to write a fascinating eyewitness account of the siege, noted, "General assault, 8,000 on St. Michael's, another smaller fortress not far from St. Angelo, 4,000 on the port of Castile, but when they left their trenches we were already at our posts, the hoops alight, the pitch boiling. When they scaled the works they were received like men who were expected. The assault lasted 9 hours, from daybreak till afternoon, during which the Turks were relieved by fresh troops more than a dozen times, while we refreshed ourselves with drinks of well-watered wine and some mouthfuls of bread. Victory was given us again, though not one of us could stand on his feet for wounds or fatigue." But by this time it was becoming plain that the Turkish army too was weakening. The heat was merciless, food was short and water shorter still, since the dead animals with which the knights had deliberately fouled the wells of Marsa had now been supplemented by large numbers of Turkish corpses. By the end of August, dysentery had spread through the Ottoman camp, its victims being carried in the blazing sun to the improvised sick tents, where they died in their hundreds. The Turks knew, too, that it would soon be the time of the equinoctial gales, which would quickly be followed by the first of the winter storms. Mustafa Pasha was prepared to spend the winter on the island if necessary, in the hopes of starving out the besieged. Pial, on the other hand, would not hear of it. His navy, he argued, was more important than Mustafa's army, and he could not risk wintering his ships without full maintenance facilities. He would be getting the fleet underway by the middle of September at the latest. If the army wanted to stay, it was up to them, but they would be on their own. Had Suleiman's forces remained, it is doubtful whether the knights in their existing situation could possibly have held out. But then, on the 7th of September, came deliverance, the Gran Soccorso, as it was called, the Great Relief, sent by the Spanish viceroy in Sicily, which had somehow managed to leave Messina despite the violence of a tempest such as had never before been experienced. Its 9,000 men were fewer than La Valette had hoped for, but they were enough. Mustafa hesitated no longer. Suddenly the guns were quiet, the clamour ceased. Instead of smoke, there was only dust from the feet of what was left, little more than a quarter, of the once proud Ottoman army as it shambled back to the impatient ships. But the Christians too had sustained terrible losses. 250 knights were dead, the survivors nearly all wounded or maimed. Of the city of Birgu, scarcely one stone was left on another. Vulnerable to fire on every side, strategically it had proved a disaster. And so, when old La Valette limped forward to lay the first stone of his new capital, he did so not on the ruins of the old one, but away on the heights of Mount Skibaris opposite, dominating Grand Harbour. As he richly deserved, the city was named after him, Valletta. Where the second L comes from, nobody seems to know. 3 years later, on the 21st of August, 1568, he died. Sir Oliver Starkey, his secretary, and incidentally the only Englishman to have fought at his side throughout the siege, wrote a Latin epitaph which can still be read in St. John's Cathedral. Translated, it reads, "Here lies La Valette, worthy of eternal honour. He who was once the scourge of Africa and Asia and the shield of Europe, when he drove off the heathen by the might of his holy sword, is the first to be buried in this beloved city, whose founder he was." One of the first buildings to rise up in the new city was, of course, the hospital. Like its predecessor on Birgu, it still stands, but it is conceived on an infinitely more ambitious scale. Its great ward, 155 metres long, is the longest hall with an unsupported roof in all Europe. By 1700, by which time it could accommodate nearly 1,000 patients, its walls were hung in winter with woolen tapestries, in summer with canvases by Mattia Preti. Mattia Preti, 1613 to 99, was a painter of the Neapolitan school who spent the last 38 years of his life in Malta. It is full of light, space and fresh air, elements in which the knights, virtually alone among the medical men of the 16th and 17th centuries, always put their trust. Moreover, unlike all the other hospitals of the time, whose patients were normally fed from wooden platters, crawling with bacteria of all kinds, the order provided plates and cups of silver, thus dramatically, if unconsciously, reducing the risks of infection. Each item was carefully numbered and stamped on the side with the emblem of the Holy Ghost. Finally, the knights knew the value of good nursing. Every one of them, whatever his seniority, would do his tour of duty in the ward, the Grand Master himself taking his turn on Fridays. For our lords the sick, as they always described their patients, only the best was good enough. With me alone do my armies triumph. Suleiman's words, when the news of the disaster at Malta was brought to him, were all too true. His fleet had remained almost intact, but he had lost well over 20,000 men, perhaps almost twice that number. Had he assumed sole command, as he had at Rhodes in 1522, there would have been none of that destructive rivalry between Piale and Mustafa. His supreme authority, together with his infinitely superior generalship, would probably have saved the day. His first reaction had been to swear personally to lead a new expedition to Malta the following spring, but he must obviously have thought better of the idea. He was too old, the distance was too great, the logistical problems by now almost certainly insuperable. Instead, he decided to launch one more campaign against Hungary and Austria. Not that hostilities with the Habsburgs had ever really stopped. At the beginning of the 1550s, Archduke Ferdinand had made an ill-fated attempt to occupy Transylvania, where, although Isabella and her young son John Sigismund continued to rule under Ottoman suzerainty, the real power rested with Father George Martinuzzi, a Croatian monk, he subsequently became a bishop and a cardinal, who had been treasurer and chief counsellor to John Zapolya, and whom the dying Zapolya had appointed his son's official guardian and regent of the kingdom. This time, for once, there had been no question of military force. Ferdinand had quite simply bribed Father George to persuade Isabella to give up the throne, promising him in return substantial estates in Silesia. It was not long before the news reached the port. Suleiman was predictably furious. He arrested Ferdinand's ambassador and locked him up in the castle of the Seven Towers, where he remained for the next 2 years, dying shortly after his release. Fighting flared up again, but it continued in a curiously desultory way. Negotiations dragged on until both parties were bored stiff, and after the death of Rustem Pasha in 1561, a peace treaty was confirmed, valid for the next 8 years. 3 years later, in 1564, came the death of Ferdinand himself, to be succeeded as emperor by his son Maximilian II. Once again there was no need for an election. Maximilian had been elected King of the Romans in 1562. His succession was a foregone conclusion. So, indeed, was his almost immediate attack on Transylvania. After all, as emperor, was it not his first duty to annihilate the enemy of Christendom? Suleiman was now well past his prime, old and tired, it was rumoured, and sick as well. Besides, Transylvania was a long way from Istanbul. Now, surely, was the time to strike. But what troops did he have to throw against him? Ghislain de Busbecq, Charles V's ambassador, regretfully reported, "Our soldiers are far from courageous. They refuse to obey orders and have little love for either work or the exercise of arms. As for our generals, most of them are dominated by greed of the most sordid kind. Others are reckless and despise discipline. Many give themselves up to the most outrageous excesses of debauchery. With all that, can we have any doubt of our future fate?" Whether or not Maximilian shared this depressing view of the situation, we cannot tell. He certainly did not allow it to deflect him from his purpose. He gathered together some 40,000 men and flung them against John Sigismund. Isabella had died in 1559, at first with some success. But the Turks struck back quickly, and Suleiman decided that he had had enough. On the 1st of May 1566, he left Istanbul for the last time with his Grand Vizier, Sokolu Mehmet Pasha, in full state at the head of an army estimated at 300,000 men with vast quantities of heavy artillery. What was needed now was a major victory, something that would erase all memories of the Maltese disaster of the previous year. The Sultan was, of course, in titular command, though he no longer had the strength to ride a horse. Instead, he travelled in a carriage the 500 miles to Belgrade. The Balkan roads, if they could be so described, were such that the journey took him 49 days. A horse would have been not only much faster, but infinitely more comfortable. Moreover, he, like the Emperor Charles, was a martyr to gout, and the weather, as nearly always on his campaigns, could hardly have been worse. Although it was midsummer, roads were flooded, bridges swept away. The cannon got stuck in the mud, and many of the baggage carrying camels were drowned. When at last he arrived at Belgrade, the Sultan wanted only rest. He did not get it. For now the ceremonial began. The welcome by John Sigismund, followed by the all-important exchange of presents. For Suleiman, a ruby worth 50,000 ducats. For John Sigismund, daggers, sabres and saddles all encrusted with jewels, a magnificent white charger splendidly accoutred, and, at his own particular request, a considerable stretch of territory between Transylvania and the River Tiser. Then there were the troops to be reviewed, the interminable banquets to be sat through, the inspections, the presentations, the common lot of crowned heads everywhere. Altogether there were just 3 days in Belgrade. Then, all too soon, the army was off again. The Sultan's original plan had been to march on the town of Eylau, which controlled the route leading into Transylvania. But while he was still in Belgrade, he received a report that Count Nicholas Zrinyi, the Lord of Szeged, had killed one of the more distinguished officials of the Sublime Porte. Such behaviour clearly deserved punishment, and Suleiman immediately gave orders for the army to march on the city. The weather showed no improvement. The journey was yet another nightmare. Finally, however, on the 5th of August, he reached Szeged, where 90,000 men and as many of his cannon as had not been abandoned in the mud awaited him. Somehow he found the strength to clamber onto his horse and ordered the start of the siege. Then he made for his tent. The siege of Szeged lasted a little over a month. Hardly had it begun when the city went up in flames. Resistance was thereafter confined to the fortress, where the count held out with dogged determination. Then, finally, when all the outer bastions were in Turkish hands and he and his 600 remaining men were surrounded in the central keep, he dressed himself magnificently, as if for a feast, it was said, and marched his men out in a heroic but suicidal last stand. Few were left alive. Zrinyi himself was badly wounded, but was not left to die of his wounds. His head was rammed into the mouth of a Turkish cannon immediately before it was fired, an unpleasant end, but at least a quick one. A few hours later, Suleiman murmured to his Grand Vizier, "The great drum of conquest is not yet to be heard." It was ordained, alas, that he should never hear it. He died in his tent, possibly of a stroke, but more probably of a heart attack, on the night of Saturday, 7th of September, 1566. He was 71. Sokolu acted fast. The important thing, he realized, was to ensure the peaceful succession of Prince Selim, who was at the time the acting governor of the city of Kütahya in western Anatolia. He was well aware, on the other hand, that once the army, and in particular the Janissaries, got to know of the Sultan's death, all discipline would collapse and there would be chaos in the camp. Those few who were already aware of it, including the doctors, he therefore executed at once. The Sultan, he announced, was suffering from a severe attack of gout, and had requested him temporarily to assume the supreme authority. Meanwhile, he sent a messenger to Selim, urging him to come at once to Szeged. One man only he took into his confidence, the chief standard-bearer, Kafa Aga. This man, who was later to marry Sokolu's daughter, was a gifted forger and could imitate Suleiman's signature to perfection. The generals, continuing to receive their daily orders just as they always had, suspected nothing. Letters were sent out to the princes of Europe, the Shah of Persia, the Khan of the Crimea, the Ottoman provincial governors, all of them signed with Suleiman's usual flourish, announcing his victory. Another letter was addressed to the governor of Buda, accompanying what was left of Zrinyi's head with a request that it be forwarded to the Emperor Maximilian. To keep the army occupied, Sokolu claimed that the Sultan had ordered the defences of Szeged to be repaired with all possible speed, and that a large mosque should be built in the centre of the city, where he intended to give thanks just as soon as the severe swelling of his foot would allow. For 43 days, the army remained in the camp, with heavily armed sentries continually on guard outside the Sultan's tent, preventing all but the Grand Vizier from entering. Only then did Sokolu give the order for departure on the long journey back to Istanbul. The Sultan, he announced, would be travelling in a closed litter. From time to time, writes the chronicler Ibrahim Pachevi, Ibrahim Pachevi, 1572 to c. 1650, was an Ottoman provincial official who became a historian after his retirement. His two-volume History of the Empire, alas still untranslated, is the chief source of our knowledge of the period from 1520 to 1640. Sokolu approached the throne, pretending to make a report to the Sultan. He also gave the impression of discussing the report with him after he had read it out. Many rumours were circulating, but the skilful tactics of the Grand Vizier managed to dissipate suspicions. No one knew for certain whether the Padishah was dead or alive. Selim, meanwhile, on receipt of Sokolu's letter, had immediately left Kutaya and, without stopping in Istanbul, had ridden on to meet his father's funeral cortege. He finally caught up with it as it was approaching Belgrade. Only then did the Grand Vizier reveal to the army as a whole that the Sultan had indeed drawn his last breath. Summoning the professional readers of the Quran to the imperial tent, he bade them recite the appropriate prayers. The full funeral service began the following morning shortly before dawn. Selim himself appeared at sunrise, dressed entirely in black. Approaching the carriage on which his father's body had been laid, he silently raised his arms to heaven as the imams intoned further prayers for the dead. When these were over, he withdrew once more to his tent. The army was already grumbling. It was a long-standing tradition that the Janissaries and other regiments received what were known as accession gifts every time one sovereign succeeded another. Only after these had been duly distributed were their recipients, though still deeply dissatisfied by the inadequacy of the distribution, sufficiently appeased to continue their march. And when at last they reached Istanbul, violence broke out again. Two distinguished officials, the Kabudan Pasha, the chief admiral, and Pertev Pasha, the second vizier, were dragged from their horses and beaten to within an inch of their lives. Sokolu himself escaped only by hurling gold coins at his would-be attackers. Order was eventually restored, but only after a number of executions and a promise from the new sultan that the Janissaries' pay would be substantially increased. Suleiman's tomb was ready. It had been designed in the year of his death by the greatest of his architects, Mimar Sinan, and stands in the small garden behind the great mosque, the Suleymaniye, that Sinan had already built in his honour. The complex surrounding the mosque also included a hospital, a medical college, a primary school, four schools for the teaching of the Quran, public baths, and a public kitchen for the serving of food to the poor. Relatively few visitors to the mosque seek it out, a pity because it is a lovely little building, domed, octagonal, and surrounded by a charming arcade on columns. Inside, the walls are covered with vast quantities of superb Isnik tiles, twice as many as can be found in the immense mosque itself. Its only defect, for which Sinan cannot be blamed, is overcrowding, for Suleiman's coffin has been joined not only by that of his favourite daughter, Miramar, but also by those of two later sultans, Suleiman II and Ahmed II. Roxolana was luckier. She has been allowed to keep a separate tomb of her own, standing a little way to the east. It is naturally smaller and simpler than her husband's, but the tiles inside are even finer, a good deal better, it must be said, than she deserved. Of all the celebrated men of history, two only are known as the Magnificent. One is Lorenzo de' Medici, the other is Sultan Suleiman. Lorenzo symbolizes the Florentine Renaissance, but even though the Islamic world experienced no reawakening comparable to that which occurred in Italy, there can be no doubt that the Sultan presided over a golden age. This was touched on briefly in the first chapter when he was first introduced. Since then, however, we have seen him principally as a military leader, and it is perhaps time to expand a little on the cultural gifts he bestowed on his subjects. He encouraged every form of artistic creativity except sculpture, at which, as a pious Muslim, he was obliged to draw the line. Two-dimensional painting, on the other hand, he encouraged, and particularly the art of portraiture. We possess a surprising number of admirable portraits of him. Titian himself painted at least five, though he never clapped eyes on his model, and there is the splendid pencil portrait by Dürer in Bayonne. We are told that no fewer than 30 painters, mostly miniaturists, worked permanently at the palace. Their output was, of course, entirely secular. Religious painting, which produced such a glorious harvest in the Christian world, was forbidden. For the rest, opinion was divided. The trouble lies in a passage of the Quran, 59:24, which states that Allah is the only Musavir, a word that means creator, but which is unfortunately used, both in Arabic and Turkish, with the meaning of painter. Must Allah, therefore, be not just the only creator, but the only painter too? In much of the Islamic world, the jury is still out, but the Turks had already settled for a compromise. Paintings, however secular, could never be hung in mosques or in public rooms. Private apartments of sultans or other important persons were, however, another matter. They might contain portraits or ideal landscapes. Scenes of pageantry or processions before the sultan were especially popular. Love scenes, however, were generally to be avoided. Architecture was largely dominated by Sinan, a Greek Christian brought up in the Devshirme system, the regular conscription and conversion of Christian children for service in the Sultan's administration or in one of the palace regiments. He began life as a military engineer, building bridges, aqueducts, and caravanserais. As such, he took part in the Siege of Rhodes, in the Belgrade campaign, and, of course, at the Battle of Mohaj. He was nearly 50 when he was appointed court architect. Only later, after the Sultan had fully recognized his genius, did he start work on the vast religious buildings, mosques and madrasas, hospitals and charitable foundations, for which he is famous. Of mosques alone, he managed to build 146 before he died in 1588, which was his 99th year. But, and this is characteristic of the age in which he lived, everything he built was devoted to religious or utilitarian purposes. We search in vain in the Turkish world for palaces or for great houses, such as the Sultan's contemporaries were building in Europe. In Ottoman lands there was never a Fontainebleau or a Chenonceau, never a Nonsuch or an Escorial. The palace of Topkapi, where the Sultan lived, is in fact nothing of the kind. It is simply a group of pavilions, many of them of a single story. Only the harem, a seemingly endless labyrinth of rooms and corridors which, extended haphazardly over the centuries, remains utterly devoid of any overall plan, occasionally strives towards elegant decoration as opposed to quiet distinction. And the harem, as we know, was for its inhabitants little more than a gilded cage. And then there are the decorative arts. The carpets, an art developed by the Turks while they were still nomads, long before they appeared in Anatolia in the 11th century. The textiles, brocades, satins, and velvets, mostly woven in Damascus, Baghdad, Bursa, and in Istanbul itself, whose workshops were the only ones permitted in the 16th century to use gold and silver thread. And finally the ceramics, the plates and vases, the ewers and cups and lamps, and above all the tiles, employed in their hundreds of thousands to adorn the interiors of the mosques, drenching them in light and colour. All the best came from the workshops of İznik, the ancient Nicaea, which reached their peak around 1550. Their designs are mostly animals and birds, flowers and fruit, and quite often that glorious swirling Arabic calligraphy, so beautiful that it provides a perfect substitute for painting within mosques and holy places, making it the Muslim decorative art par excellence. Suleiman the Magnificent, the 10th and greatest of the Ottoman sultans, was a statesman, a legislator, and a patron of the arts. First and foremost, however, he was a soldier, and he died, as we are told, good soldiers wish to die, with his troops on the field of battle. There are those who argue that he should not have kept his eyes fixed so determinedly on Europe, that he would have achieved far greater conquests had he turned them to the east, following in the footsteps of Alexander the Great. With his vast army and his limitless wealth, he could almost certainly have vanquished Babur, his almost exact contemporary, who, with his victory at Panipat in 1526, had founded the Mughal Empire in North India. There had, in fact, been one Ottoman expedition in 1538, which had gone so far as to besiege Diu, the large Portuguese fortress on the west coast of the subcontinent. But it had failed, owing largely to the stupidity and incompetence of its commander, Hadim Suleiman Pasha, a eunuch of Greek origin, aged over 80, and so fat that it took four men to raise him from his seat. He was, notes André Clot, with commendable understatement, probably not the ideal choice. And thereafter the Sultan seems to have lost interest. So it was Europe that remained his objective, and it was in Europe that he died. And when, on that fateful September evening, it was a Saturday, He took his last breath. The Ottoman Empire began that remorseless decline that was to continue for the next 3.5 centuries. 9. Worth celebrating. The death of Suleiman before the walls of Szeged brings our story to its end. Of the 4 princes who together constitute the subject of this book, only he completed his 70 years and 10. None of the other 3 reached even 60, Francis dying at 52, Henry at 55, Charles at 58. But there, lives were, as we know, shorter in the 16th century, and they differed from our own in many other ways as well. To take but one example, the 3 Christian rulers were, in ways that we can hardly imagine today, all dominated by their religion. Henry VIII spent 7 years of his life arguing with the Pope about his divorce from Catherine of Aragon before he finally rejected the whole concept of papal supremacy and established the Church of England. Francis I, whom we tend to think of primarily as a flamboyant Renaissance prince, was burning heretics in the Place Maubert as early as 1523. Though the persecutions became much worse after the Affaire des Placards in 1534, and were ultimately to develop into the hideous wars of religion that were to continue till the end of the century. Charles V fought the Reformation with all his strength, did his unsuccessful best to prevent it spreading through the states of North Germany, was responsible for the burning of many a heretic at the stake, and spent his last years in a Spanish monastery. Suleiman, as a Muslim, cannot obviously be properly compared with the other 3. Many writers testify to his piety, and there can be no doubt that he conscientiously obeyed the call to prayer and the other requirements of his religion, as did virtually all his Muslim subjects. But Islam is, to its credit, a simpler faith than Christianity, and we somehow feel that the Prophet Muhammad loomed less large in the Sultan's day-to-day thinking than did Jesus Christ in that of the princes of the West. He did, however, possess one quality that was signally lacking in Francis and Charles, and increasingly uncertain in Henry. That quality was tolerance, an instinctive respect for the beliefs of others, and a readiness to allow them their own customs, traditions, and forms of worship. In Suleiman's dominions, tolerance was absolute. If only his fellow princes had followed his example, how much happier Europe would have been. In other ways, too, the Sultan was the odd man out. The 3 Westerners were all related by marriage. Henry was Charles's uncle through Catherine of Aragon. His sister was married to Francis's cousin, Louis XII. Charles and Francis were brothers-in-law, and though none could be said to have known each other well, they had at least met. Charles had visited England 2, once in May 1520, and he had seen Henry again in Picardy a month later, immediately after the Field of the Cloth of Gold, and in the summer of 1522 he was in the country for several weeks. He was to meet Francis at Aiguemont in July 1538, and again when the 2 travelled across France together in December 1539, and January 1540. Henry and Francis had met first at the Field of the Cloth of Gold, and then again with Anne Boleyn in 1532. None of the 3 Christian princes, however, had ever encountered Suleiman, who remained to all of them a somewhat shadowy figure. To Henry, indeed, he was of relatively little importance. One should, he observed, be more apprehensive of a certain other person than the Great Turk, of one who devises worse things against Christendom than the Sultan, pointing darkly across the channel. Cardinal Wolsey went even further. The Turks were so remote, he said, that they really did not affect England at all. For neither the Emperor nor the King of France, on the other hand, was it possible to forget Suleiman for very long. The Sultan was keeping up a relentless pressure on the eastern borders of the Empire. In 1529, besieging Vienna itself, and although Charles's brother Ferdinand was bearing the brunt of the aggression, it was obviously the Emperor who was ultimately responsible for the safety of his Hungarian subjects. Nor was the danger confined to Eastern Europe. The corsairs of the Barbary coast, who also owed allegiance to Suleiman, constituted an ever-present danger to the coasts of Spain, the Balearic Islands, and Sicily, a danger so great indeed as to persuade Charles personally to take part in 2 expeditions to North Africa, that which captured Tunis in 1535, and that of 1541 which so humiliatingly failed to take Algiers. More important than any of this, however, was the simple fact that the Emperor was by definition the protector of Christendom, to whom the Ottoman Sultan represented Antichrist. In his youth, Charles had dreamed of a glorious pan-European crusade that would drive the infidels back to the Asiatic steppe from which they had come, allowing Constantinople once again to take its place as a Christian capital. In his later years, he had come to accept the fact that this could never happen. A dream it would remain. But he personally could never have treated Suleiman with anything but bitter hostility, and he never forgave his brother-in-law for the increasingly friendly relations that he maintained with the Sublime Porte. Francis naturally viewed the Sultan in a rather different light. He was penned in by the Empire, Spain on one side, the Low Countries, Germany and Austria on the other. He could not forget that he had spent more than a year as Charles's prisoner, while his two sons had passed four precious years of childhood in captivity as hostages for their father. The former Duchy of Burgundy constituted another running sore in his relations with his brother-in-law, as did his claim to Milan. It was no wonder that the two were almost constantly at war with each other. What the king desperately needed was an ally against the emperor, and Suleiman, who alone was able to exert pressure on the empire from the east, was ideal for his purposes. The Sultan's one disadvantage was his religion. From time to time the Pope would start talking about crusades, and Francis, as the most Christian king, would be obliged to pay lip service to any call on the armies of Christendom. But lip service it remained. It was perfectly plain that, for any number of reasons, 16th-century Europe was incapable of launching a crusade of the kind that had been possible three or four centuries earlier, and Francis soon became adept at smoothing over any signs shown by the Sultan of a ruffled temper. We read with something approaching astonishment of the Franco-Turkish siege of Nice in 1543, and of how the old pirate Barbarossa and his entire fleet then wintered in Toulon until the following April. On occasions such as these, eyebrows were raised all over Western Europe, and Francis had a good deal of explaining to do. But somehow, even after Barbarossa had, on his return journey, ravaged several islands that were indisputably imperial territory, he managed to get away with it. Of the four great principals in our story, Suleiman was, as we have seen, the last survivor. Already, on the Western political stage, there had been a major change of caste. The age of the giants was gone. The second half of the 16th century consequently possessed a flavour remarkably different from that of the first. It boasted one monarch, in the magnificent shape of Queen Elizabeth I, as great as, or perhaps even greater than, any of our four protagonists. But only one of her contemporary rulers was of any real interest to her. Her brother-in-law, Philip of Spain. And Philip was lugubrious, sanctimonious, and more devout than even his father had been, though nowhere near so intelligent. In France, Henry II, Francis II, Charles IX, and Henry III formed a dismal quartet indeed. It was only with the arrival of Henry IV in 1589 that things cheered up. In the Empire, Charles's brother Ferdinand and Ferdinand's son Maximilian were curiously dull. After them, Rudolf II was colourful enough, but he was to spend most of his life studying alchemy and astrology in Prague. As for the Turks, it is sad to have to record that while Suleiman could and should have been succeeded by his son Mustafa, who possessed all his father's qualities and who would surely have led the empire on to further triumphs, his eventual successor, Selim II, always known for very good reason as the Sot, was to prove the nadir of the Ottoman line. With him, the demoralization of their once formidable empire was well underway, as was its long, slow but steady decline. But the first half of the century, now that was worth celebrating. Has there in all European history been a half-century like it? Here, packed into the space of just 50 years, are the High Renaissance, Luther and the Reformation, the exploration of the Americas, the panoply and pageantry exemplified by the Field of the Cloth of Gold, and above all, those four magnificent, memorable monarchs, each of whom, individually, left his indelible imprint over the land he ruled, and who together transformed the civilized world. This concludes Four Princes by John Julius Norwich, narrated by Julian Elfer. Copyright 2016 by John Julius Norwich. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with John Julius Norwich, care of Curtis Brown Limited, and was produced in the year 2017 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.